Agenda item number 16, this is a briefing on the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and Jim, I'll turn it over to you. Or Phil first? Your name came up first on the agenda, so.
Think they're gonna tag team with it?
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Director Montour, Deputy Director Spiller. Good to see everybody. Nice to be back. Jim and I are truly a team sitting before you today to provide a briefing on the Pacific Salmon Commission, the treaty, and the renegotiation process that the commission is engaged in. This briefing is intended to provide the commission with an overview of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. The Pacific Salmon Commission, which is the body that is charged with the implementation of the treaty, and an overview of the renegotiations of several key chapters of the treaty that has critical implications to the interests of Washington State. This may seem a little like trying to take a drink out of a fire hydrant, even though I know some of you have had considerable experience in the Pacific Salmon Commission process, including Commissioners Kehoe and Commissioner Carpenter. Jim and I are not going to try to cover everything today in one session, and perhaps you will consider inviting us back at a later date after the renegotiation process has progressed. We will, of course, leave that to your good judgment, but please know we will be happy to do so, and as you will hear, we think it is an important topic for the commissioners to be knowledgeable about and given the responsibilities that you have been charged with. I have been and will continue to communicate and coordinate closely with Director Unsworth as we go through this process. Director Unsworth has sat in on portions of our U.S. section meetings. He has a place at the Chinook negotiating team table, and I will continue to work closely with him. There are really three sets of negotiations that are taking place, and they're sequential in nature. The first is the negotiation to come up with a South position. When I talk about the South, I'm referring to Washington, Oregon, and the tribes in the South. We need to have a single position to take to the U.S. section table, which is where the second negotiation takes place. And that negotiation is essentially between the South and the state of Alaska. And that negotiation then leads to the formulation of a U.S. position that then we take to the third set of negotiations, which is the negotiations with Canada. I will not be going into any of the specifics relative to the ongoing negotiations today. We'll provide you some information about some of the key issues. Our objective is to leave you with a foundation of understanding of the process, our general objectives as we enter these negotiations, and some of the key issues. This is one of my favorite maps that you see on the screen here because I think it really depicts the intergovernmental and international context and complexity of salmon management. As you can see, we have, and as you well know, we have a lot of our stocks that originate in Washington and Oregon that migrate to the north, up off the coast of British Columbia, and some on into Alaska, that make this treaty extremely important, both from a conservation as well as an allocation perspective. You'll see this map a few more times before we're done. You can also see that British Columbia, their stocks indicated in the green, also migrate to the north for the most part, while some of their stocks also come down through the Strait of Juan de Fuca, in particular Fraser River sockeye and pink salmon. Oregon also has a significant interest. Their coastal Chinook stocks are what we characterized as a far north migrating stock and are also subject to interceptions in British Columbia and Alaska. We're going to cover these seven items here today. The commission structure, going to tell you a little bit about what I refer to as our team, a little bit about the U.S. section structure, how it works, the context of this treaty in terms of it being a management cornerstone, both, again, from a conservation and allocation perspective, the principles that are captured within the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and then renegotiating the treaty, and some discussion about the consequences of failure. So, from a commission structure, and we'll show you an org chart here in a minute, each country has four commissioners. The U.S. commissioners are appointed by the president, although there are some that sometimes a presidential appointment can take a good deal of time, and in the interim, an appointment can be made by the Secretary of State. The state of Alaska has a commissioner. Currently, that is Charles Swanton. The tribes have a commissioner, and currently that is McCoy Oatman from the Nez Perce tribe. I am currently one of the four commissioners representing the interests of Washington and Oregon. And Donna Darm is currently the commissioner representing the Commerce Department. Donna recently took Bob Turner's place in that role since Bob's retirement, although Bob continues in this process as what we call a shadow to Donna Darm. And we'll let you know what a shadow is here in a minute. Each commissioner also has an alternate. So Bill Auger is Charlie Swanton's alternate. Ron Allen is McCoy Oatman's alternate. And McCoy and Ron alternate from year to year. One year Ron is the commissioner. The other year McCoy is the commissioner. So this happens to be the year in which McCoy is the commissioner. Rick Klump is my alternate. Rick is from Oregon. And David Hogan is the representative from the U.S. State Department, and he is Donna Darm's alternate. Here's just a org chart of the commission. Obviously, at the top, we have the eight commissioners from the United States, which includes the commissioner and alternates. We have eight commissioners from Canada. Off to the right there, you'll see the Northern and Southern Fund Committees. I'll talk a little bit more about those as we go through the presentation here. We have the panels. I won't read them all, but a real important one for us there are two, the Fraser River Panel and the Southern Panel. Commissioner Kehoe is on the Fraser Panel. Commissioner Carpenter is on the Southern Panel. In terms of committees, you'll see those. They do include, I would call out your attention to this, the FNA is the Finance Committee. There is a Selective Fishery Evaluation Committee. That's the Selective Fishery one. All of our selective fisheries are reviewed by that group. And then you can see the others. The Chinook one there is the Chinook Technical Committee, very, very important committee that advises the commission on technical aspects of Chinook management. They are also the ones that are charged with coming up with what we call the abundance indices, which lead to the establishment of the catch quotas in the fisheries off southeast Alaska, northern British Columbia, and west coast of Vancouver Island. Our team, my shadow, I'm extremely fortunate to have Jim Scott as my shadow, which means that Jim is my primary support person. I want to thank Director Unsworth for making Jim available for this and for this role. I couldn't do my job without him. You'll also see here on the panels, Southern Panel, as I've mentioned, as part of our team, what we're calling our team is Commissioner Carpenter. Of course, we have the department's staff, which include Lori Peterson and Annette Hoffman, and then on the Fraser panel, Commissioner Kehoe, Kurt Hughes from the department, Jack Girard from ReefNet Group, and of course, Kyle Addix. I won't read the rest of those names, but I wanted to impress upon you that we have a really great team, largely made up of Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife staff, and they're a great group to work with. Turning now to the U.S. section structure, and when I talk about the U.S. section, there's probably a couple of circles. If there's an inner circle, it would be the commissioners and alternates. If I go out and were to draw another circle, then I would bring in each one of the commissioners' shadows. And as I drew a circle out from there, there are other people that come into the section, what we call the section meetings, as needed, to bring expertise to the table. And in the case of Washington and Oregon, we also have a seat to table for Director Unsworth. So when we're sitting around the table and we're trying and we're working on development of a U.S. Position or addressing issues that are going to come before the bilateral session, the commissioners and the alternates are treated as equals, even though the commissioners are the ones that have a vote at the table. The alternates engage in the conversation. As do the shadows. We really encourage the shadows who bring separate expertise to the table, particularly shadows such as Jim Scott and Craig Bohe from the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission assist in the discussion at the U.S. section table. We can also designate others to be a part of the U.S. section meetings, as I mentioned. U.S. positions are established by consensus only, and that's pursuant to the treaty and the implementing legislation. So that makes it extremely important to have good communication, good relationships, good working relationships within the U.S. section. The commission has also established a Chinook interface group. We call it the SIG. I am the chair of the SIG and for the U.S., and we are assigned certain tasks to assist with implementing the Chinook chapter by way of interfacing with the Chinook Technical Committee, and there we come back and make recommendations to our respective sections coming out of the bilateral SIG and or make recommendations to the commission at the bilateral table depending on the instructions. So I wanted to just talk a little bit about why I think this really is a management cornerstone. As I mentioned, and when you looked at that map and you understand the migration patterns of stocks that originate in Washington and Oregon, it's hard to imagine managing these stocks without a treaty and agreements with both Canada and Alaska. The last in line bears conservation burden. So if you think about that, in the absence of an agreement with Canada and Alaska that limits the number of Washington origin fish that are taken their fisheries, the entire conservation burden falls on Washington and or Oregon in the case of Oregon stocks. Conversely, stocks originating in Canada are vulnerable to Washington and Alaska fisheries, and absent an agreement with the United States that limits U.S. catches, Canada would bear the conservation burden for the stocks originating in their waters. So in our, from our perspective, management failure is absent a U.S.-Canada Pacific Salmon Treaty. The management structure will collapse, leading to conservation and allocation concerns. Concerns is understated for sure. I'm not trying to be over dramatic here with the term collapse, but I believe that that's exactly what will happen in the absence of a treaty with Canada. And as a reminder, that's where we found ourselves prior to the time that the treaty was established in 1985. Interceptions of Washington fish were ramping up in British Columbia, particularly in off the west coast of Vancouver Island, northern British Columbia, and Alaska. I remember well being in the hotel room in Vancouver, British Columbia, when the last two-week negotiating session was going on, and Canada had taken 2.3 million coho off the west coast of Vancouver Island the previous year, while the majority of the Washington fisheries were closed to protect coho salmon. There are some principles that are embodied in the treaty. I pulled these out. There are a few more, but I think these are the really important ones. Each party, the party in these cases being the United States or Canada, shall prevent overfishing and provide for optimum production. Each party shall receive benefits equivalent to the production of salmon originating in its waters. Each party shall cooperate in management research and enhancement. It is desirable, and this is taken right out of the treaty, it is desirable in most cases to reduce interceptions. It is desirable in most cases to avoid disruption of existing fisheries. So if you can imagine when we started in 1985, the potential for disrupting existing fisheries was present, certainly. And as this treaty was implemented, there was a desire to avoid that if possible. So I have three slides here that address this question of has the treaty been effective? And I suspect that everyone will have their own perspective about whether or not it's been effective. And one of the measures to answer that question is to look at what had been happening in terms of interception of our stocks prior to the treaty and what is happening now. So in this particular graphic, we're looking at South Puget Sound Chinook, and we're looking at pre-treaty levels of catches of these fish, and you can see here in Canada that their catches of those fish were much larger. Alaska, as you will find, for the most part, does not catch very many Puget Sound origin Chinook salmon. The southern U.S., so SUS is southern U.S., so what's going on in the southern U.S.? Well, we're also taking a lot less fish than we were at pre-treaty times, largely due to the decline in the number of South Puget Sound Chinook. And then what's happening with spawning? We are doing better now than we were then. Looking at the Washington coast, and you'll see that it's looking specifically at the queets. We have three indicator stocks that the Chinook Technical Committee uses as indicator stocks: the queets, the HOCO, and the Suez are the three. So when you hear percentages about coastal stocks taken north of the border, those numbers are coming from those three stocks. Or certainly you can look at any one of those stocks. So in this graphic, we are looking just at the queets. And we can see that pre-treaty, there were larger numbers of Queets Chinook being taken in Canada. There are a few more of them being taken in Alaska now than there were prior to the treaty. There are a few less being taken in the southern fisheries, and the spawning has increased fairly significantly with the treaty's regime. Third stock is the upriver bright Chinook. So everybody's familiar with upriver bright Chinook, I think. Our biggest natural Chinook stock that we have, originating in the Hanford Reach. And we can see prior to the treaty, Canada was taking far more of those fish. Alaska was taking far more of those fish. The U.S., southern U.S., is now taking far more of those fish than they were. And as we know, we've had we've had strong runs of upriver brights, and our spawning escapement is about the same, but it's in good shape, whichever time period you want to look at. So those are three examples of how to maybe look and ask yourself the question, has the treaty been effective? Here's a busy one. I know you're not supposed to do this, put a busy slide on a PowerPoint, and Jim discouraged me from doing this, but I usually listen to him, but here's Skagit is a good one to look at, and we'll also go over here and look at Nooksack. So the purple, these are total mortalities, okay, in the base period of our current annex, which is from 09 through, this data goes through 14. So we count escapement in the total mortality of a particular brood year. And so over here you can see escapement is in purple. So let's take a look, and we'll look at terminal, which is the orange. I don't know what that is. I guess it's yellow. Is it orange? Okay. So here's what's going on in terms of escapement. Here's the terminal area fisheries. Here's Puget Sound, so our marine water fisheries. I'm having to hold this really tight because I drank too much coffee this morning. Canada, this is a other category. Here's the west coast of Vancouver Island up here. And here's Georgia Strait. So east side of Vancouver Island. Alaska, you can't even, I think there is a little sliver at the top there, but it takes virtually none of these fish. So if you look at the total mortalities and you're thinking, west coast of Vancouver Island, they take a lot of our fish. Canada take a lot of our fish. We look at this row. We look at that. Those right there represent the proportion of the total mortality that's being taken of these fish in Canada. And so we'll go over here to Nooksack. And it's a little different picture because you can see there's more fish taken in the west coast of Vancouver Island fishery of Nooksack. It's probably our... If I had to pick a stock where the impacts are the greatest in Canadian and Alaskan fisheries originating from Puget Sound, Nooksack would be the one I'd pick. But here we've got the escape, and of course we got to remember we're talking about very small numbers of fish in the case of Nooksack. So that's why we've got a really small terminal fishery. There's hardly any. This is probably all... CNS, 20 fish. Ceremonial subsistence. Here's a little bit in the Puget Sound marine fishery. So if that's 20, that's probably, 35. But so very small numbers. So it can be a little deceptive that way, but we have a run that's in dire condition and here's where the mortalities are taking place. This one is our three, what we call our coastal indicator stocks, HOCO, CLEATS, and SUEZ. And so much a different picture, but I'll just pick the CLEATS. So here's our escapement. Here's the terminal fishery. So that's sport and tribal net fishery. Here's west coast of Vancouver Island. So, boy, not much. But here you got the Southeast Alaska troll fishery, a much bigger piece. And here's northern British Columbia troll fishery. So a much different picture than what the Puget Sound stocks are. Much greater impact in Alaska, smaller in Canada. And if you, pick another one of these, if you look at the HOCO, there's not much of a fishery at all on the HOCO in southern U.S. The mortalities that are occurring are up here, west coast of Vancouver Island and northern, southeast Alaska and northern British Columbia. So we'll change gears here just a little bit and talk about the renegotiations that are ongoing. All of what we call the chapters, so there's a chapter for Chum, there's a chapter for Coe, there's a chapter for Chinook. Those are all expiring in December 2018. And as a result, the limitations on interceptions for those fish end in 2018, absent a successful renegotiation of the treaty. The commission has split up the responsibilities for renegotiations of those chapters. The southern panel, the northern panel, the transboundary panel, and the Fraser panels have the lead for renegotiating. I don't want to throw a whole bunch of different terms. Annexes, you can substitute chapters in your thinking about that, that deal with Chum, Pink, Sockeye, Co., and transboundary stocks. Now, they've been given the responsibility to provide the commission the results of their negotiations. If they're successful, chances are the commission will, I shouldn't use the word rubber stamp, but I suspect we will accept the outcome of their negotiations. If they're not, or they reach an impasse, then the terms of that, the negotiations of those chapters will come to the commission for resolution. The Chinook chapter is the one that the commission is doing itself. We're taking the lead for the renegotiation of the Chinook chapter. So we have a time frame that we have imposed on ourselves that all negotiations are scheduled to be completed and submitted to the respective governments by March of 2018. We need the new treaty in place beginning in 2019. The governments, our respective governments that need to approve our work, are going to need at least 9 months in order to decide whether to approve our recommendations or not. And so we don't have a lot of time left. So I wanted to talk just a little bit about our objectives, and I would put this slide up. These objectives are those of our teams. These are not necessarily the objectives of the U.S. section. but they are our objectives. We want to be able to see if we can build in how we can consider and be responsive to climate change and environmental conditions. There was a little bit of discussion about that in your public testimony today about the Willapaw. And as we all know, survival rates, particularly marine survival rates, are particularly sensitive to ocean conditions, and to the extent that we can figure out a management regime that acknowledges those and takes those into consideration, we'd like to do that. Not an easy thing. Puget Sound Chinook, we'd like to reduce the interceptions in Canadian fisheries from current levels. And that is driven primarily by our conservation concerns for Puget Sound Chinook. They continue to struggle, as you all know, and they've continued to decline in many cases. So our argument, or our basis for reducing interceptions in Canadian fisheries for Puget Sound is largely driven from a conservation perspective. Washington Coastal Chinook, we want to reduce interceptions in northern fisheries. This is a combination of conservation as well as allocation, but I would put allocation as the primary driver for this objective. We have seen increases in the number of coastal Chinook being taken in northern fisheries since this chapter was put into place, so we're anxious to look for ways to reduce that and bring more of the benefits of those stocks back to Washington citizens. We have an issue about management objectives. There's two things having to do with management objectives here. The first one is clarify our obligations for stocks not meeting management objectives. Right now there are two. There's what we call the general obligation. There's a general obligation for the country of origin to reduce its fisheries if a particular stock isn't meeting its management objective. And there's a second level reduction also specified in the current language in the Chinook chapter that hasn't proven to be very useful. In some cases, the general obligation is more than what the second level reduction requires. So we're spending a fair amount of time looking at, working on what the obligations are when you have a stock that's not meeting a management objective that's specified by the commission. Management objectives and the review, we've only got, I think it's 48% of our stocks that are managed under the Pacific Salmon Treaty that have approved management objectives. In order to have an approved management objective, they need to be approved by the Chinook Technical Committee. And most of Alaska's stocks have approved management objectives. Very few of the Canadians have management objectives that are approved. And there are relatively few Washington stocks that have approved management objectives, in particular Puget Sound. And there's a debate over whether or not your management objective has to be expressed explicitly in the number of spawners and as to whether or not exploitation rate types of management objectives are used. And there's, I would say, a philosophical difference within the Chinook Technical Committee relative to that issue, which has led to issues associated with not having management objectives that are used by this body as well as the tribes and within our co-management structure that have not been approved by the Chinook Technical Committee. So we're working on trying to figure out a way through that around that so that we can have a greater number of our stocks that have approved management objectives within the Pacific Salmon Commission.
Can I ask a question? So as you look at the, as the commission looks at the obligations, is that based on where there are management objectives in place, based on past performance and then sort of developing the response in advance? How's that done?
If we, and Jim, feel free to jump in here if I stumble on this one. If we have a stock that has a management objective that's been approved and there is the preseason forecast would indicate that we're not going to meet that management objective, then there's an obligation by the where the stock of origin to implement a reduction in its fisheries. Fill that in.
60%.
60% of the
base.
So when we looked at the, we have a base period, and let's say you have a, let's say you have a 50% exploitation rate in your base period, and so you need to make a 60% reduction. So that'd be, 30, you'd have to reduce it down to 20%. Or it's the other way around, 60% of the base.
Yes.
Yeah. So 40. Thank you. So there we, and there is, that's, it's an international obligation. It's not something that you can decide to do or not decide to do. And we do that through our North of Falcon process. We look, that's part of the consideration. As we go through the North of Falcon process, as we go through the Pacific Fishery Management Council process, to ensure that we've met our international obligation.
So I have a follow-up question. So what happens to stocks that don't have management objectives? How does the commission deal with those?
Well, that's therein lies the problem, because if we don't have a management objective, then the then there's an argument the general obligation doesn't apply. And that's a, well, that's a problem. On the other hand, I guess from when I put my, if I were sitting over there and I had that hat on, I'd say that we have management objectives that are well established, that are agreed to by the co-managers and or have been approved by NOAA through a biological opinion and consultation that we manage our stocks to meet. So it isn't like, well, there's no management objective, so you don't have to do anything, or you get a pass. And in many cases, particularly those for those stocks that are listed under the Endangered Species Act, our management objectives are more restrictive than the general obligation.
Okay, so it comes down to also the application of some of the principles that you had on the earlier slide. And one of the principles is that the place of origin should benefit most from the production of those fish. So how does this square? How does this make any sense, given that the conservation burden is falling on the place of origin?
There's dueling, if you think about it, there's dueling principles. One is that the conservation burden primarily falls on the country of origin, and the country of origin should receive benefits equivalent to the production. So there's, in times of plenty, the benefits the principal would have the majority of the benefits of the production going to the country of origin. And at the same time, if there's a conservation issue, the other parties don't get off free, but the primary responsibility is that of the country of origin from a conservation perspective. So it is a, there are dueling objectives and principles that we have to deal with.
Yeah, I think that's the, one of the fundamental, you know, things that it's difficult for us to understand, given that we're supposed to benefit looking at the coast, looking at Willapa. We're supposed to benefit. That's just a general principle that should apply at all times, not just at times of planting. And so the conservation burden falling on the place of origin seems to be at war, in conflict with that concept, that we always are going to be in the position of giving up more in order to secure that conservation. And, it, and I know you're trying to give us the general picture, so looking at just Willapa is not probably the only thing we need to do.
Think about another example of like Thompson or Fraser Coho, where there's a, depending on the status of the stock, but in 19 out of 20 years, the stock is in the low category, where Washington is bound to have exploitation rates of no more than 10%. So there is a the greater in many cases the greater conservation burden for that stock has fallen on Canada. They have not had an exploitation rate that is as high as 10% when we have had 10% exploitation rates. So it would be good to take some examples of a couple different stocks and look at how this these principles apply. But if in particular some of those graphics that we looked at, while we have a stock that is in not in very good shape, you'll see that the impacts in the north are less than they are in the south. So we have had increases in our inside, what we call our individual stock-based management group. So everything except the ocean to the north, all the rest of our stocks under individual stock-based management. And in many cases, the south's impacts have gone up during the term of this annex, so since 2008. And they have gone down in fisheries to the north. So, just running through our objectives here, we talked about the two management objective piece: maintain the current structure of Coho and Fraser annexes in principle. And then the other piece that's important is to simplify the annexes slash chapters as needed to improve implementation. And that there are some examples of language that are in the Chinook chapter in particular that have been almost impossible to implement and either very costly or we simply don't have the data to do it. So we want to take a close look at that and make sure that the terms of the chapter are something that we can implement. So we're just closing in toward the end here, but I wanted to talk a little bit about consequences of failure and or what's at risk. Obviously, in the absence of a treaty, each party loses the limitations on interceptions by the other party of salmon originating in its water. Obviously, that's a big deal. The other consequence is that absent success at the commission table, so if the commissioners are unable, if the United States and Canada at the commission table are unable to reach an agreement, government officials from Ottawa and Washington, D.C. will take over these negotiations, and as a result, they will take over the management and the internet from and the international aspects of salmon management on the West Coast. And that happened in 1999. The last thing that, from my perspective, that we want to have happen is to lose control of the management of our fisheries and have folks on the other side of the country take that over. There'll be a cessation of the southern and northern endowment funding, and I'll show you a slide here in a sec about what that means. But there are significant financial benefits that accrue to Washington and to this agency by having this treaty. There are funds made available to us that we wouldn't otherwise have that are critical to managing our fisheries. Here's a pie chart of the 2015 distribution of monies coming out of the endowment fund. That pie chart represents $75 million. There are two fund committees. There's a northern and southern fund committee, and the parties can provide or make proposals for projects to those fund committees. They are bilateral fund committees that make decisions on where the endowment funds are spent. And in this particular year, you can see that Canada's projects received greater than 50% of the money, but that again came out of a bilateral group that made that decision. But you can also see WDFW there with a substantial chunk of the pie. I don't have the number that equates to, but it is in the millions of dollars to be sure. There's also money that comes out of, there's essentially three funding sources for the commission. One out of the State Department that largely funds the Pacific Salmon Commission offices and that function. A second that comes out of the Department of Interior, Bureau of Indian Affairs, that provides money to the tribes. And there's a third part that comes out of the commerce budget. It's within the salmon management line item. It's been just over $10 million. A portion of that comes to Washington directly. And there's also a portion of it that's been used for things like monitoring and sampling of our salmon fisheries, coated wire tag collection in Ketch County. So there are some significant dollars at risk here as well. There's some what I call other applicable law to think about. If I'm in Alaska's seat, their coverage from endangered species perspective for their incidental takes of endangered species originating in Washington come from an incidental take statement that's premised that there is a Pacific Salmon Treaty and that they are operating their fisheries in a manner that's consistent with the treaty. So in the absence of that, reconsultation will most certainly take place, and the outcome of that would be uncertain in terms of whether there are the same level of allowances of incidental takes in their fishery. And this next one is a big one. It's what we call the North-South Sharing Agreement. And there's a stipulation that came out of a lawsuit in 1985 under this case of the Confederated Tribes of Yakima versus Baldridge. And I apologize, Secretary Baldridge, I have an extra D in your name. But basically what it says is that there's an agreement between, and all of the U.S. v. Oregon and all of the U.S. v. Washington tribes are party to this stipulation. And it essentially says that our treaty rights are I want to pick my words carefully. there is a fair sharing pursuant to our treaty right under the terms of the treaty. And we are going to set aside our legal differences as to whether catches by that are taken in Alaska by non-Indians in Alaska count against the non-treaty share. So if you think about that, if we had to calculate a treaty non-treaty sharing formula that was consistent with U.S. v. Washington and U.S. v. Oregon, and we had to add in the fish that are taken in Alaska to the non-treaty share, that would not be to the best benefit of Washington non-treaty fisheries. So having this stipulation in place is really important. Now, certainly not suggesting what an outcome might be if that was put in federal court as to whether or not Alaska's catches count against the non-treaty share or not, but there's an argument to be made, certainly, that they do. So this stipulation terminates in the absence of a treaty and an agreement. So it's an important piece. So this is my summary slide. These are Jim and my thoughts. We believe it's critical to the future of our salmon stocks and our fisheries. We believe the treaty will require new money from federal sources. And just as a reminder, last time when this treaty was renegotiated in 2008, $30 million was paid to Canada. And they took a 30% reduction in catch to address primarily the status of Puget Sound Chinook stocks. Alaska received $15 million. They took a 15% reduction. Now, we can ask ourselves whether or not we think status quo for another 10-year period works without any additional money, or whether we've already paid for the reduction and that payment is into perpetuity or not. But to think that we are going to get an agreement that doesn't include some significant dollars, whatever those dollar amounts are, is probably wishful thinking. And our ability to secure federal dollars will depend on the support for whatever it is we negotiate. Absent support, dollars will be hard to come by, and the house begins to crumble again. I don't want to minimize in any way the challenge we have in front of us. We have competing interests. We have stocks in some cases that have declined from where they were when this treaty was last negotiated, particularly on the Chinook side. Canada's looking for reductions. Alaska's looking for increases. We're looking for reductions. Those don't fit together very well. So we're going to have to figure out a way to look at the other person's perspective and see if we can craft an agreement that meets our principles and our objectives and at the same time is acceptable to them. So that's what we're going to be continuing to do. We have set up two special negotiating sessions with Canada. One is in April, and one is in September. We have had special sessions of the U.S. section already. We had one in May. We had one in August. We had one at the end of November. We have another one. We have several others scheduled, three or four of them. So there's a lot of work being done, But we have not got to the point where we have sat down with Canada in a serious way and put a U.S. position on the table, because we don't have one yet. But we are continuing to work with our counterparts in the section to develop one. So that's our best effort to give you a little drink out of the fire hydrant of the Pacific Salmon Commission. Again, Jim, of course, will be working closely with Director Unsworth, and he will be a part of our negotiations as we move forward. We appreciate your attention this morning, and we're happy to come back at a later date and provide you an update with how things are going.
Thank you, Phil. We'll look forward to that update. Questions?
Yes. That was really a good first look. And I guess I'm left because obviously my perspective on this question of prior intercepts is based in issues on the coast in Willapaw, and I would say the entire west coast of Washington. So what I'm concerned about is a couple things. As you painted this picture, it's pretty clear that we've got the U.S., Washington, the Southern group has a lot of different areas to worry about. We've been putting a lot of our money into making things better for the Puget Sound ESA stocks. What worries me is, at the same time we're putting most of our eggs in that basket, the coast is declining. The stocks along the coast are in decline, and we're headed towards ESA listing. And it might not be soon, but it looks pretty inevitable to me, because so many of the wild stocks, Chinook stocks along the coast, are in a downward trend line. So how do we take care of the stakeholders who are putting the money into salmon habitat restoration, into fish production, taking the conservation burden? Is this going to be a deal where the coast just gets traded off for the larger interests of the state in Puget Sound? That's a concern that I have, because I don't see the U.S. putting millions into saving Willapa wild Chinook until they're listed. And is that what we have to do, just wait until they're listed under ESA for the conservation concern to get real? And so it comes down to, how do we, what interests are represented faithfully, authentically in this negotiating process? Is it the business interests primarily, and conservation taking a second back burner position? These are not questions. These are just concerns that I'm expressing. Maybe you have a reaction to them.
Thank you, Chair and Commissioner Wecker. I like where we are strategically for coastal Chinook. There could probably be a place that I could imagine that might be better, but strategically, I believe that Canada has some serious concerns for their coastal Chinook stocks. We're going to hear more about that from them in January. I believe that if Puget Sound were healthy and there wasn't the interest on the part of the co-managers in Puget Sound, and there is a big interest there to reduce interceptions of Puget Sound stocks off primarily off of Canada. If we were not in that position, and we had a single argument about coastal Chinook and our concerns for coastal Chinook, I believe that that would put us in a weaker position than it is having the better part of 17 tribes and state interests in Puget Sound that are looking for that reduction. We have 4 coastal tribes that are very much interested in coastal Chinook, are very much interested in looking for getting greater numbers of Chinook back to Washington waters. Even if the reductions only came as a result of concern for Puget Sound, there is going to be a benefit to coastal Chinook as well. So I think the fact that we have multiple interests, maybe for different reasons, looking for reductions in fisheries where coastal Chinook are intercepted, that we are in a better spot than we might otherwise be. So I do have a little different perspective, I guess, on where I think we are strategically relative to coastal Chinook. The other thing that I would say is that we only have one stock that's being used as an indicator stock that has similar characteristics to Grace Harbor. I put Grace Harbor and Willapaw together. And that's the Queets. You know, how well does Queets and the distribution of Queets represent the true interceptions of Grace Harbor and Willapaw stocks in northern fisheries? That's a question I posed to my buddy here. And so we're going to be working on looking at coated wire tag recoveries to make sure we have as good of information as we can about the interception of those stocks in northern fisheries and not solely rely on the indicator stock of Queets to tell us the story.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Phil, could you address, without divulging any of the negotiating strategies, for example, how you foresee the South interacting with Alaska and how NOAA fits into that discussion and outcome?
First of all, Alaska's got they put a lot of staff resources and a lot of money into this process. They get a lot more money than Washington does to participate in this process, and there's a story to that that I don't like, and I really don't like to tell it. But we've worked, when I say we, I mean Jim, and in particular Jim Scott, and I have worked real hard to establish sound working relationships with our counterparts in Alaska. Commissioner Swanton came in January, 2 years ago this January, worked real hard in establishing a good relationship with Mr. Swanton. Doesn't mean we always agree, that's for sure. And Jim's been working real hard with some of his counterparts in Alaska. So there's no secret. I mean, they're coming to the table looking for more, you know. So we are on different. We have different perspectives, but you know, negotiations are about relationships. At the end of the day, I think. And if you have a lousy relationship with the person across the table, the chances of you reach an agreement aren't very good, even if you can find a place to agree. So I think rebuilding good, solid relationships is a place that we've been focusing our efforts, and to understand where Alaska's coming from. You asked about Canada. Canada's got a strong team, And I've known, you know, I've been back in the commission process, the Pacific Salmon Commission process, since 2010 now. I've been assigned as the lead negotiator for the United States. My counterpart is Sue Farlinger from Canada. She just retired. She was the regional, kind of the, I don't know exactly what her title was, but she was essentially the regional lead for DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans, the federal arm in Canada. And I have, you know, we work well together. And as Jim works well with his counterparts in Canada, they've got a great, some other really good people, Paul Sprout, Rebecca Reed. Paul is my counterpart on the Chinook Interface Group. He's there. He's the Canada chair for this. So if you come to the table and you have a common conservation objective and principle, and that leaves how to go about addressing allocation, and then you look to the principles of the treaty where the country of origin should get the benefits equal to the production, I think that's the place you start from.
So I have one follow-up. I guess I'd, maybe if you want to, I guess what I'm asking a little bit is, in the South we have our ESA list of stocks in a number of places. Canada has its Species at Risk, which is a similar name for ESA. How NOAA ultimately gets involved in that when Alaska is wanting a bigger section of the pie and we've got ESA and Species at Risk issues in the South, how does that play through when it gets down to crunch time?
I'm not sure I understand the question. So you know, NOAA's going to be looking at this through a couple of different lenses. Certainly they're going to be looking at this through the lens of the Pacific Salmon Treaty and what the principles are. They're going to also be looking at having an outcome where they can do a biological opinion and come up with a no jeopardy opinion. So if they see that the regime that's being negotiated falls short of what they believe an outcome of a biological opinion resulting in a no jeopardy opinion would, that would be a result. They've made clear already, they've put a few markers out there already that would suggest that they're going to be watching that closely. So they'll definitely have a role there. They're also going to be looking out carefully, you know, the other applicable law piece from being consistent with the Magnuson Act, ensuring that it's based on the best scientific information available. And they're going to be looking out for their as a trustee for the tribes, ensuring whatever comes out of this, that at the end of the day, the tribes are comfortable with the agreement and that their treaty right is being honored. So I think those are a few of the lenses that NOAA is going to be looking at this. And even though they don't have a vote at the commission table, if they send a signal that whatever regime is being negotiated is not going to result in a no jeopardy opinion in a biological from an ESA perspective, those of us who have a vote are going to have to change where we're headed.
Yeah.
Because we know that it will be a fail. Even if we agree, we'll have a failure.
That was very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. So,
yeah, Jim.
I want to make a comment, and mostly just thanks, Phil, for all your work on this committee. The committee's the commission's been working extra hours this last couple years. I know that there's been several extra meetings, lots more. I don't know how many weeks total, but it's got to be, I don't know, 8-10 weeks total time. That's just in meeting time. And these two are doing yeoman's work there and representing Washington really well. I've watched a few days here and there, and it's a tough negotiation. It's almost like a three-country negotiation, and from as an observer. And anyway, just thank you, and thanks, Phil, for coming back and all your knowledge you're applying to this. And then just a shout-out to Jim Scott and Craig Bohe, too. This is a forum where co-management really seems to work. The tribal folks that are at the table are very engaged and helpful, and the team, particularly the Southern U.S. team, work together, I think, in a remarkably cohesive way and are doing a great job. So thanks
Jim. Thanks, Director.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you again.
Nice to see you.